Hello, welcome to Countersign. This is Stuart Motha. In these podcasts, I discuss books, films, and other materials with their authors and creators. As this is the first Countersign podcast, I want to say a few words about why I embarked on this project. Like many others, I read books with a pencil in hand, often circling and underlining words and phrases and making marginal notes. In one sense, this is a way of being attentive to the work that I'm reading, but also connecting my own projects with the material in the book. Part of the podcast series is about creating new opportunities to interact with the authors of books, makers of films, and other materials. In a sense, it's a way of slow reading and thinking being extended by way of a new encounter. It is an acknowledgement that thinking and the creation of meaning occur collaboratively. In that spirit, I was fortunate to meet Patricia Williams earlier this year. Her book, The Alchemy of Race and Rights, was extremely influential in my thinking and orientations as an academic. We met in February and took her 1997 BBC Reith Lectures as a point of departure for thinking about race relations as they were back then compared to what they're like now. Of course, this was several months before the horrendous and sadistic killing of George Floyd in Minnesota that has reverberated around the world. If our discussion took place now, this would certainly be at the center of our conversations. However, as you will see from the content of our interview, Patricia talks about notions of open unaccountability and the impermeability of white power. She describes the move from culture wars to a civil war with increasingly militarized police and armed right-wing militias. There is also a discussion of the rhetorical and visual strategies deployed by President Trump to provoke and sustain racial domination. While the second half of the interview is focused on new technologies, the commodification of bodies through biotech, data gathering, and the predictive futures facilitated by algorithms, Patricia is keen to remind us that we must retain a sense of the past. It is in that spirit that I hope the interview offers insights for thinking about the present. Welcome, Patricia. It's
lovely
to speak with you. I was delighted to find the 1997 BBC Reith Lectures and the fact that you had given them. It was 2 years before I had arrived in the UK, so I wasn't previously aware of them. So it was lovely to find these lectures. And I thought it would be useful to use that to use those lectures as a sort of temporal marker of the state of law and politics in relation to race, gender, and sexuality, and indeed many of the cultural conflicts, what are referred to as culture wars, that were taking place certainly back then, but have intensified now. So when you look back at that period of time in 1997 and the lectures, how do you reflect on how you saw the challenges back then? And what has come of those challenges?
I don't think I think I probably go through life as a bit of a pessimist, but I don't think I anticipated this the intensity, the tremendous backlash through which we in the United States, at least, are living, and I observe at some distance happening here, if to lesser degree, and by lesser degree, I mean less armed.
Yes.
I'm very concerned that there is a kind of militia mentality in the United States that makes the culture wars, with the emphasis on culture, of the 1990s, reconstitutes it with the emphasis on war.
Yes.
Culture dropping out of the diction, and civil war, a resurrection of the civil war, being heard more and more on the far right, but the far right advancing into the main halls of our political institutions. And that's a quite worrisome difference.
Absolutely.
Between then and now.
And yet, the late 90s, that sort of moment of the new millennium, was also seen as a point where certain conflicts and around race, for instance, had transformed. That there was some movement since the civil rights struggles and decolonization, and there was a sort of optimism around multiculturalism, let's say, certainly in the UK. And what we are seeing now is, as you said, a considerable backlash. But before we move on specifically to the backlash, do you want to perhaps comment on whether there, in fact, were such successes?
My sense was that I had been invited because, from a British perspective, the United States had made more progress, had come to terms with the question of the legacy of segregation and slavery as an interior influence, or colonialism as an interior influence. I thought that it was optimistic then, a little bit more optimistic than it deserved to be. I think the rise of conservative think tanks at that point, the rise of shock jocks in the United States, the arrival of Fox News in the United States was already worrying me, but I don't think it was such a prominent presence that it. I wanted to ride the optimism that somehow the civil rights organization in the United States had a stability and an influence on cultural discourse, and I think it did. So that was one level of it. I think the other level, which is not which was not so much part of the discussion, is that it was easier to hear a critique of race from somebody who was outside the UK.
Yes.
When I look back, in all modesty, I really think that Stuart Hall ought to have been giving the brief lectures. And I was flattered and carried away by it, but Stuart Hall, as my respondent, feels exactly backwards.
Yes.
That, frankly, I think had to do with the difficulty of talking about race and Great Britain and hearing it from the inside as opposed to the outside.
Absolutely.
So.
Yes, certainly Stuart Hall and Catherine Hall's wonderful work on the history of slavery has helped Britain to understand itself, if it pays attention to the work that they have done on culture and slavery and colonialism. But there is certainly a sense at the time in the late 90s and the early 2000s that multiculturalism had become a sort of consensus, a sort of liberal consensus. This may not have been the language that was used in the United States.
Oh, it was.
It was,
but it was already beginning to be bastardized.
Yes.
And so multiculturalism, instead of being celebrated as a kind of cosmopolitanism or as a polyglotism or some embrace of we are the world, the kumbaya language that it had been perhaps in the 70s and 80s, it was already beginning to have its signification turned inside out so that multiculturalism was becoming monoculturalism.
Yes.
Multiculturalism was being attacked as tribalism.
Yes.
And the verbal walls, not yet the actual walls, but at that point the verbal walls were going up against multiculturalism,
yes,
being an invasion of some kind or as a fragmentation that was dangerous.
Yes.
So I think that we were right on the cusp of that. And again, people like Rush Limbaugh, to whom Donald Trump just gave the Medal of Freedom, which I find utterly shocking, but at that time was speaking, as he does now, about African Americans as primitives with bones in their noses. He attacked gays, women, in the most vulgar language. And at that time, that was still breathtakingly shocking. But that was, the fact that that was happening was bubbling at that point. And it was still controversial that he was on the air at all, and mm-hmm. that those like him were beginning to be subsidized and sponsored by a great deal of private money. So it was a beginning, an incipient worry, but I think I was still hoping that this would be not become the resurgence that it clearly has.
Certainly the radio shock jocks, as they're called, and certainly very dominant in the United States and also in Australia, which is a context.
It's Rupert Murdoch. Yes,
absolutely. It's the sort of Murdoch empire, and the influence they have on politics being so considerable. And we've moved technologically, of course, quite significantly to social media, now being the channel through which these manipulations and influences take place. But at that time, so it was certainly the right wing backlash to diversity, respect for difference, multiculturalism, so forth. There was also a critique on the left, and I remember Nicholas Rose writing about this in Economy and Society, I think in 1996, where the politics of difference, as it was called, was seen as a fragmentation of a leftist politics that was organized around class. So there was also a discomfort, if you like, in the left that was seeing certain kinds of socialist horizons or basically the politics of class being sidelined by what the left saw as a fragmentation of the ways in which groups are mobilized to struggle against oppression.
And I think that Nicholas Rose is British.
Yes.
And I think that the way in which we discuss race and class in Britain and the United States is vexed with regard to that particular critique. Because I think that class is the dominant discourse of discussing division, and there is a given vocabulary through which race gets almost suppressed. At that time, at any rate, there was the sense that class is more important than race. I think it was precisely the reverse in the United States. And so in the United States, that same critique, frequently made, I think to this day, still gets heard as a way of deflecting from what we feel is the dominant division, which is race. To talk about class is to deal with the enormous affective power of not just economic position, but of the untouchability, the degree to which race is, and particularly the black-white legacy of slavery, division of race, determines life outcomes so powerfully. So I think that was the problem with that ever having any traction in the United States. And you still see that to some degree with Bernie Sanders' ascendancy, concern about how race and class do a dance.
Right. And do you feel like the way in which issues of disadvantage are tackled, again, in the rhetoric of Bernie Sanders, for instance, tends to be more focused on issues of class rather than being able to take
on the issues of race more directly.
Yeah, I think Bernie Sanders has a, you know, is not quite as reductive as that. He's accused of not being a true socialist as well.
But, yes.
But yes, I do think that class, in the context of racism in the United States, is hard because it doesn't, or many of the accounts really don't take into account the degree to which race is itself a kind of commodity being transferred in a way that affects others on the economic spectrum very differently.
Mm-hmm.
And the class analysis doesn't adequately unpack.
Absolutely.
And I think give voice to this. Yeah.
I think you make that point very powerfully, you know, from the outset in the book The Alchemy of Race and Rights, when you talk about the difference between you and a white male professor who are going to lease a property, and the significance of the contract for you. Whereas where the white male would be comfortable with a certain kind of informality, and notwithstanding the fact that you were a respected professor and you had this tremendous education and you had effectively a certain kind of class position, there was a difference from him.
And even though we were both going, or I was at any rate, going into a transaction with friends, it meant something to assume a formal position with regard to it, because it meant that I was approaching them as a full actor, as an agent, as a and that it was a sign of respect.
And
that gestural dimension of being a contractor as opposed to being the object of contract was very important on both sides of our transaction. And I think that that's a you know, my sense of adherence to that status is a erased marker in my in my own self-presentation that really defies the logic of the economics of that contract.
Absolutely. So from that moment and sort of moving ahead from the late 1990s, the end of the Clinton administration and the beginning of the Bush number two administration, which is now retrospectively very significantly marked by 9/11 and the post 9/11 politics and law,
and the lawlessness,
and the
breakdown of due process in the institution of torture and disappearances, and I think that that is a moment, and the passage of the so-called USA Patriot Act, that to some degree did grant extraordinary executive power that it seems our current administration is not just discovering but exploiting. To a fairly well,
Absolutely. Yeah. So there was a sort of intensification of the projection of U.S. power globally on the back of the events of 9/11, and a shift of focus in terms of our critiques as well. So we started to, particularly as lawyers, pay a lot of attention to what was happening in Guantanamo Bay. The extraordinary renditions and torture, as you say. But at the same time, there was a massive enlargement of the prison industrial complex, the number of black people in prisons. And it was almost probably accurate to say that the more sensational actions of the Bush administration post 9/11 in terms of their international orientation distracted some of us. I would take responsibility for this myself, in that we started writing about the international actions of the US administration, while so much was being inflicted on the black population in terms of...
I think there was a lot going on then. There's more going on now, and now it feels in retrospect that we should have paid more attention to this or that. But there was a lot going on in that in those times. Just as now, it's very hard to keep up with all of the diminishment of legal protections or processes that, you know, so much is evaporating and so much happens so quickly. It takes time to reveal, oh, this is where it began. Oh, we missed this particular signal. Yeah.
Yeah. And are there particular things, do you think, that we missed? Because I think we became very excited, certainly internationally, by the election of Barack Obama. This seemed like a very important moment in American history, but also in the global context that the world's number one superpower has a very cerebral black president who was symbolically, culturally, intellectually inspiring for so many people.
And is still, those of us who still cling to that inspiration.
And how? So how do you see the shifts from as they took place from Bush to Obama?
I think one of the things that I think worked quietly, even through the Obama administration, was again what I just pointed to—the beginnings of a kind of privatization, a secret state that began with torture and the sort of the open unaccountability, if that's not too paradoxical, of that began with the invasion of Iraq, that began with Guantanamo Bay, and that leached into carceral politics domestically, including the privatization of certain prisons. And I think the move toward taking public institutions and having them administered by, quote, outsourcing, destroyed a certain expectation of accountability and public oversight that has mushroomed to this current moment. So there's now a coming together of responsibility for life and liberty in prisons, but also it being administered by private companies that have no, absolutely no accountability to anybody, and about which the public, I think, largely has no knowledge. So I think organizations like Executive Outcomes, which began and really had their heyday in the invasion of Iraq, are now those executives have changed the company names, but they are working now in schools, in detention centers, in prisons, in the administration of prisons, in private security companies that come in and work in public in public schools. And so I think that that's a major shift, and that has existed sort of as a just beneath the skin of our political system, and is now really emerging as a big problem. So it was disguised as a kind of tax revolt all the way back in the 1980s, but it really was put to a kind of surveillance purpose during the 1990s, and now I think it's so pervasive that it's a kind of libertarian stream of destroying most of the public administration of anything except the military. So that's one thing. The election of Barack Obama still amazes me. I think it was such an extraordinary accomplishment. And the fact that he served two terms with completely, with no scandals whatsoever, despite how many people were gunning for him. And I have many concerns about his policies. You know, people, I think, imagined he became a sort of floating signifier for the left. You know, he was, you know, he was Mahatma Gandhi. You know, he was Malcolm X. He was Martin Luther King. He was God. Without actual attention to the fact that he was a fairly middle-of-the-road political figure, as ideologically at any rate. There was nothing revolutionary about him. But he was coherently within the mainstream of American politics, and he did that much brilliantly and legitimately and with clean hands. I mean, I think that's his legacy. Like many African Americans, I had hoped that just the symbolic power of seeing somebody in the White House and the nice family and the good grandmother and the extraordinary good-naturedness and the hard work and the incredible narrative power of the way in which he and his wife mm-hmm. spoke would transform or chip away at some of the stereotypes. But I was also quite worried, and I think that obviously history has shown us that I was not wrong, that his image in the White House was almost like a traumatic reiteration of the post-Reconstruction backlash. Mm-hmm. And it was my major critique, then and now, of those who rushed to embrace his election as post-race, mm-hmm. as the advent of post-race moment in America. Mm-hmm. That seemed ridiculous. That seemed utterly ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Particularly as we had mass incarceration, mm-hmm. as you had profiling, as police profiling of all sorts. There was so much going on that was clearly about racial division and the beginnings of anti-immigrant feeling, particularly in parts of the Southwest. Mm-hmm. And again, we've had such... People forget how recent this history is. You know, the 20th century was marked by militia mm-hmm. resurgence. I think at that time, I still didn't appreciate the power of... the quiet power of internet in organizing far-right. Mm-hmm. But even without that, I was very worried about the power of a very familiar post-Reconstruction backlash, the vocabulary that some on the right were using, and that Donald Trump burst onto the scene using to a fare thee well. And he used, I mean, I think it was predictable that he would give a Medal of Freedom to Rush Limbaugh. Rush Limbaugh, when he first came on the scene, was considered funny. Mm-hmm. Many people who didn't consider themselves conservative, to say nothing of right wing, said, oh, I like listening to him because he's so funny. He's mm-hmm. such an idiot. Oh, he makes me laugh. Mm-hmm. And I think that the same kinds of things, the same kind of appeal, is what Donald Trump mined so well.
Yes, and of course Boris Johnson.
And Boris Johnson,
this exploitation yeah. of... and I want to go back to the phrase you used mm-hmm. earlier, which is the sort of paradox of openly unaccountable.
Yes.
Yeah. The way in which that assault on what is a consensus of respectability, yes. Of public service, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Of the limits of the Constitution,
yeah.
Or indeed, for example, Trump's attack on Barack Obama's citizenship, yeah. where he yeah. was born, that yeah. he could be so openly absurd mm-hmm. in his assertions. Yeah. And people could sort of laugh at that.
Yeah.
Indeed, President Obama himself mm-hmm. laughed at that. I remember the correspondence dinner yeah. where I think that was a very...
Apparently Donald Trump made the decision that evening to run for president. At that
right.
point.
Yes.
Yes.
You know, where
do not laugh at Donald Trump. but he laughs at everybody else. And
yes.
that mockery, that political mockery has become quite poisonous in a way that... There's a wonderful piece by a philosopher named Lynn Terrell called mm-hmm. Genocidal Language Games.
Mm-hmm. Sort
of, and she talks about how the genocide in Rwanda was preceded by several years of radio programs in which there was mockery of one half of the population.
Mm-hmm.
And the mockery got more and more pointed, but it was always fun, and the radio would be blaring in bars, and people would be sharing their banana
mm-hmm.
beer,
mm-hmm.
mocking. But it slowly became more and more insidious with people called parasites now.
Yes.
And ultimately, people were called snakes. And in Rwanda, children grow up knowing how to kill snakes. They take up a machete and they kill a snake. That's how they're raised.
Yes.
And the moment snakes became the term of disparagement, it no longer became a joke, people actually began to pick up machetes and kill the symbolic snakes.
Yes.
And it worries me terribly that we're using that neo-Nazi language or that genocidal language in the United States of parasites and of animalizing and of objectifying, making inanimate, devivifying, consigning to civilitare mortuis, that we are, that they are dispensable and disposable, so many people who are being penned and caged.
Mm-hmm.
I worry that under circumstances like that, it takes a spark. Donald Trump, even when he was campaigning, when he said, I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue mm-hmm. and shoot somebody and nobody, I thought that was an amazingly evocative image that called up young black men in the middle of Fifth Avenue. Who is it that he's talking about? Who's going to stand that he's going to shoot in the middle of Fifth Avenue?
Yes.
And in the backdrop of that, there were all these images, videos of you know, dash cams of people standing in the middle of Fifth Avenue who were being gunned down. And I thought that it wasn't just about him. This was a call to arms that was quite insidious and quite dangerous, and you see that flowering now. It both aggregated a certain impermeability of from prosecution that we're seeing now. People cite that a lot, you know, I could do whatever I wanted. But the way in which he put his focal power in the invisible, unnamed body in the middle of Fifth Avenue, it seems to me that the answer to that was that image of the city of Richmond with everybody on Martin Luther King Day in the old capital of the Confederacy.
Yes.
And people said, oh, well, it was a peaceful march, even with so many people with arms. And I said, is this really the image of peace? I think that we really need to think what we are communicating, not just in these words of dehumanization, but also in the visual images at which Donald Trump is so expert, that belies the incoherence of some of his tweets or words or the misspellings and all of the rest. Visually, he gestures to his earliest audiences, which were when he was an impresario of wrestling.
Yes.
So the wrestling matches over which he would go back, and I don't know how many in a British audience are familiar with the degree to which he and Vince McMahon, who ran the wrestling franchise, would get into the ring together and verbally box, and it was very performative and very funny. But he reiterates some of those performances visually over and over and over again. Even when he appeared at the Republican National Convention, he came up behind a scrim in exactly the way he used to come out in the wrestling matches.
Right.
So a lot of people just don't take him seriously because of that background, which a lot of people in broadsheet media or mainstream media don't even know about. They've never seen the kinds of wrestling matches to which he became familiar. This is even before The Apprentice. That pugilistic, tossing his shoulders back, the jutting jaw, the very performative clothing that he wears sometimes. He looks like Mr. Moneybags from the 1930s Monopoly games sometimes. And I think that people underestimate what he's doing with all of that. Mm-hmm. And I was one of the few people who actually bet that he was going to win the election. I should have bet a great deal more money, I would say. And I'm very worried that he's still working a kind of visual culture with what he telegraphs.
And certainly those sorts of strategies of the language, the symbolic gestures, very similar things can be said of Boris Johnson.
Yes.
The ways in which he was perceived to be a sort of jolly chap.
Yes, yes.
Not to be taken too seriously.
Yeah.
Surely even the Conservative Party would have the good sense to not see him as... As Prime Minister, but of course he was writing those columns referring to Muslim women who would wear the hijab or jilbab as post boxers, and the sort of really outrageous uses of demeaning and dismissive language, and how that links to the politics around immigration and xenophobia.
I mean, my favorite political cartoon is, I think it was in The Economist, Trump and Johnson are facing each other in profile, and their hair is combed forward and entangled.
Yes.
And it just, it's their costumes are linked and braided, but they are, the enormous power of that silly hair. Everybody talks about the silly hair. But their ideology is braided together. They are the advisors that are transatlantically communicating policing strategies, surveillance strategies, privatization strategies.
So the dimensions of privatization, and indeed how this has shifted the challenges is also taking place through the development of new technologies, and that's something that you're tremendously interested in and have written a lot about over the years, particularly the commodification of bodies, women's bodies, babies, in the context of new genetic technologies and genetic manipulation.
And algorithmic. It's not just
It's not just the biotech.
But it is, just the modification of the data of our bodies.
Yes. And,
facial recognition, we are being scanned constantly, and there's, if we have a mythology of being, of constructing our own persona and walking through the world with a sense of, a mask that protects our privacy.
Mm-hmm.
I think the technological persona that each of us is being read. There's Rosie Bradotti, who's a wonderful philosopher, who just came out with a book called Posthuman, and it begins with an observation that frequently when we're online, we get one of those little squares that says, show me you're not a, show me that you're human. Show me you're not a robot.
Not a robot, yes.
And you literally have to convince the algorithm that you are human, that it is the machine that is the determinant of our humanity.
Yes.
And that constructed sense of persona is now not, maybe we never had control of it, we were all cultural and contingent beings, but it is built into the architecture of this new technology to determine who we are, what gates we can pass, what borders we can't go through, who we really are. Facial recognition doesn't recognize me. I am not who I am.
Yes.
As far as the, and this is a whole new construction of citizenship, of participation in public places, and we don't have, I think, the governance structures or the vocabulary to call this theft, or to call it, there's so much, such a rapid generational shift of young people who haven't thought about what really loss of privacy means, or who haven't experienced a surveillance state from which none of us can escape. So that's one dimension of what worries me. I also worry about the temporal reordering. I think we're losing a great deal of the archive of history, because the architecture of being online all the time means that we know everything that's happening on the planet in this 6 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
But the long view, we forget what happened yesterday. I think that's another reason it's so hard to figure out what is happening, to compare what's happening now with what happened in the time of the second Bush administration. Things happen at lightning speed, and the human brain is leaping. We're like little jackrabbits for the next bit or bite of news. Things do happen at a faster speed than they did. But I think this is discombobulating all of us, and it's consuming the time we don't read like we used to.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's just that we've switched to reading something different. But I think that the loss of a sense of the past is worrisome, and the degree to which algorithms really vaunt you into a predictive, hypothetical future, not the future as inherently uncertain.
Yes.
And so that's a very different way of conducting oneself in the world if one is constantly living in a bubble of risk and prediction. And those kind of calculations affect who gets what job, where we are permitted to live. And then finally, of course, all of this architecture, or much of it, because it is as yet so ineffectively governed, is proprietary. And that's another domain over which we have very, very little oversight or knowledge about what is going to be done, what is being done with this data. And that is crystallizing around us in ways that make traditional legal structures almost irrelevant or bypass them entirely.
Yes. I think the interesting, again, the sort of paradox here is that we go into interactions with this technology, the embracing of social media, Facebook, Twitter, and so forth, on the basis that it provides us an opportunity to re-personify, if you like. We work with the fiction that we are still presenting a person.
Yes.
That is somehow coherent and whose integrity we can hold on to.
Yeah.
But the sense is that actually that's dissipating. That as soon as you're out there, you're being observed and surveilled and commodified and so forth. So there is a sort of a paradox that. I think this also comes up in some of your work on the genetic technologies. Mm-hmm. Is that there is there's a notion of freedom of contract,
mm-hmm.
or freedom of expression, or freedom of exchange, that is driving what the conscious being thinks they're doing when they enter into these new relations,
mm-hmm.
but that. Liberal idea of the contracting individual
mm-hmm.
is really no longer the platform on which we stand.
And you know, the distribution of ourselves, that utter fragmentation and distribution of ourselves is not yet, I think, something we're, as a polity or as a general matter, that we understand.
Mm-hmm.
And there may be ways of understanding it. It's interesting. I listening to some theorists who think about indigenous cultures where the sense of distribution of what we are, who we are, mm-hmm. overlaps or, you know, so exceeds the bounds of our bodies. But I think that this mechanical distribution of self, that sense of almost Zen escaping the body in a meditative sense, is very different from what is the distribution of the self and its body parts when you are giving away your genetic information. You're not just giving away yours, you're giving away your entire family history. When you are using the womb of a woman in India for surrogate production of a child who becomes a commodity in the very vocabulary of that contract, mm-hmm. which is the product, when you can... I think this shifts major definitions of what motherhood is,
mm-hmm.
when we fragment it into gestational carriers and purchasing agents in mm-hmm. the production of children. I think CRISPR-Cas9, the ability of individuals to change germlines over future generations, the ability of Google or Facebook or... frankly, some of my students who have their own little startups to conduct human experimentation without our knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
All of this radically shifts our ethics, but also our sense of what the human is.
Yes. Absolutely. I mean, you've written about this in your article, Babies, Bodies, and Bios,
mm-hmm.
Which was published in the Columbia Journal of Gender and Law, and some incredibly evocative examples and parables, mm-hmm. in a sense. Mm-hmm. You take the examples and you build parables out of them, and one of the examples is of Marlies Munoz, who is a deceased woman in the state of Texas, where the hospital wanted to keep her on a life support system because she was carrying a 14-week-old fetus on all evidence had some developmental injury themselves. And in fact, the partner of this woman had to go to court to get an injunction to let the deceased woman die, as it were. So and I think you raised the question of, well, what would have happened if this was not actually a person who had that relationship with the husband but was a surrogate mother, had contracted effectively for her body to be a vehicle,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
For carrying baby, and how would the court have dealt with that kind of contractual relationship? The transformation it's a transformation in one sense, but of course this is a harking back also to slavery and the use of women's bodies as carriers of a commodity.
Ultimately, in the United States, we understand the fetal personhood movement, or even the blastocyst personhood movement, or that there is a, you know, recently in Ohio there was a an attempt to pass a bill saying ectopic pregnancies should be reimplanted by doctors. It's impossible. But the construction of that kind of, you have a, a fertilized egg, and it is a full person in the eyes of the law, is a kind of construction of a corporate. It's a little bit like Citizens United, you know, that gives an extraordinary kind of legal power over the full body of a woman or of a surrogate or of a, you know, or over the mechanics of reproduction. That actually puts a body at war with itself. So it makes the developing body, whatever one wants to call it, it imagines it as discrete from all of the epigenetic interconnection of blood and cellular activity. And it redefines us in our relation as purely genetic. So there's a gene-centric dimension that gives ultimate importance to genes as expressive. I even heard an ethicist recently saying that genes have a First Amendment right of expression, which again is not about the fetal as person or genes as expressive of speech. It is about giving the researchers and the technologies around these things power that pit them against the body of Marlies Muñoz, for example, or of women who who are carrying these contracted for.
Yes, I remember the controversy at the time that the human genome was being mapped, and Paul Rabanov wrote about this in a book called French DNA, where the French government became extremely nervous that genetic material was being shared internationally, and that there was this race to map the human genome, and at some point declared that, well, actually something called French DNA needed to be protected. And the sort of the absurdity that a genetic, any kind of genetic material could have a nationality
or a purity at all. And it is that concern continues in the law in terms of citizenship. You know, our administration in the United States is now looking at women who come in to see whether or not they're pregnant, because so it's unsettling questions of birthright citizenship. There is much more emphasis, I think, around the world, around bloodlines as determinant of political recognition. I think DNA analysis companies like 23andMe have certainly contributed to this, or even Eurovision. Eurovision, the music competition, spent a great deal of time advertising kits. You know, each of the singers, let's see what their actual DNA shows in relationship to their political identity. And I think that we are seeing a shift in making politics biologically or genetically, not really in a comprehensive sense, even biologically, but again, gene-centric.
Absolutely. And the sort of return of eugenics, you've probably seen, as we speak right now, there's been the controversy that Prime Minister Johnson's office had employed someone who was promoting explicitly eugenic ideas.
Racial eugenics.
Racial
But even eugenics, even more, you know, mainstream, and again, George Church is controversial for all kinds of reasons involving de-extinction and so forth, but he has recently proposed a dating service that would look at certain genetically implicated diseases in terms of pairing people for a dating service. So this emphasis on breeding that take us back, you know, hundreds of years. I despair.
Yes. So I think two more questions. One is that you draw from this, these instances and cases, and it's a sort of style or method in your writing and your thinking, that you draw a sort of parable. Uh-huh. You present a story from uh-huh. which we can think of the ethical and political mm-hmm. dimensions of a problem. I wondered if you'd sort of comment about that approach to tackling the issue, because I mean, one of what's really important about it, I think, is that you don't sort of get into asserting propositions mm-hmm. of solving the issue. Mm-hmm. In a sense, there is something that is about enabling thinking in taking that approach to a problem, yeah, that you yeah. open up sets of questions without saying, well, actually, this is what the human means, or, yeah, you know, this is the nature of the essence of whatever yeah, problem yeah. you're looking at.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trained as a lawyer. Mm-hmm. I was trained to abstract. I was trained mm-hmm. to follow the propositional model. My background is really in the study of rhetoric. Mm-hmm. And I think, and semiotics back mm-hmm. before, I mean, in the early days of semiotics.
Right.
If I look at the power of the civil rights movement, and I grew up within that culture of people who talked their way out of slavery, that it is the power of storytelling. It wasn't the power of abstraction. It wasn't mm-hmm. the power of law. It wasn't about using data to show that it's better if you don't own somebody than if you do. It really is the power of giving life to the data. And I'm not somebody who... Mm-hmm. I've been accused of being anecdotal, and I appreciate that. Yes, I like a good anecdote. Maybe that's my talent, telling a good anecdote. But I also try to respect the ethics of telling stories that are not simply the exceptions to the rule, but to really illustrate large public concerns. That's my goal, to give them life in ways that allow us to collectively think about things. Mm-hmm. And so I was a trial lawyer, and so I certainly, you know, part of being a trial lawyer as opposed to an appellate or, you know, making appeals, is that you reason by juicy analogy, you know, whatever mm-hmm. it is, mm-hmm. to make the jury sit up and think about it. You know, I remember when I was doing trial training, one of my trainers, you know, picked up an apple, took a pencil, and stuck the pencil into the apple and said, "This is what the prosecution is doing to our argument," you know, and it's ridiculous. It has nothing to do with the actual facts, but it illustrates it in a way that you go into the jury room and you're thinking of that apple. And, mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, we are analogic creatures, and to make it as alive as possible is important. So I view storytelling as its own kind of revelation. The ability to hide people in cages or hide people behind walls. When you cannot get bodies out, then you need their representations. You need stories. You need, if you can't get photographs, you need images in your mind. You need analogies to other experiences that are on the other sides of the world, that live among us, to reestablish that sense of connection.
Mm-hmm. No, I absolutely agree. I mean, I often say to my students, even when I'm teaching the cases that are the sort of higher appellate decisions, that they need to see it as a crystallization of a story, that these were all kinds of human relations and social relations that come together in a case.
As an application, And that's, you know, I've been talking a lot with friends of mine who are computer scientists, and just the notion of equality, for example, has such a different meaning in mathematics than it does in legal life or social life. Just the meaning of the fact that something is elegant in that all the math works. The application of algorithms in certain social settings, like in courtrooms, is frequently argued by computer science as, well, we're going to have more equal outcomes. Everything will be more even, and the machine is more neutral. But that question of neutrality is not the same as neutrality in social science or neutrality mm-hmm. in terms of justice, which also introduces some notion of forgiving, of mm-hmm. forgetting. And algorithms never forget.
Yes.
And algorithms don't do things at the individual level. They do it with comparison to broad populations. and the exceptions drop out. And that's part of the, you know, the concern about doing this so broadly, or things. There's a wonderful book by Virginia Eubanks that talks about the application of algorithmic logic in the instance of child custody. Mm-hmm. And it's a cruel, cruel application, even though by some numerical discourse it looks like everybody's being judged by the same standard. But the outcomes are horrendously cruel and nonsensical when transferred into the discourse of human life prospects for these particular children.
Finally, in many of the examples that you relate, and some of these your own experiences, mm-hmm. I think of the ones in your Reith lectures of seeking a mortgage.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or going to try on some shoes and only being given one shoe.
Yes. Yeah.
Until you purchased both shoes, and these instances of racial prejudice, mm-hmm. And the experience of it, and I often think of the image that I draw from Derek Bell's Faces at the Bottom of the Well, I think, which is where he spoke about this, this sort of sense of red yeah. rage that yeah. comes upon one when you're yeah. when you're experiencing this kind of mm-hmm. prejudice again. And but even that, being aware of that, involves what W.B. Du Bois referred to as a form of mm-hmm. double consciousness, that you're yeah. experiencing yeah. something, but you're also holding yourself
yeah.
Separate from that person who is experiencing it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so there are these strategies,
yeah.
Double consciousness being one of them, or understanding that something like a rage is taking place.
Yeah.
That is the experience. And there is a, I think, a cumulative, and perhaps even an intergenerationally cumulative legacy, stress.
Yeah, there's a stress in that, yeah.
I wanted to ask about the ways in which you think about
I think that you know, and it's one of the concerns I have about algorithms again,
yes.
or a completely, you know, a world in which we are constantly surveyed, like the credit system that China's developing,
yes.
or that maybe in a free market sense that we just don't know about it so much, but that we're all being watched, and it's disembodying in the sense that double consciousness, as W.B. Du Bois wrote about it, and as Frantz Fanon
mm-hmm.
also talked about it, as a way of the colonial subject stepping out to watch others watching him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that sense of never being at home completely in your body, but mm-hmm. always watching what somebody else is watching you, because they could kill you, or because you have to be on guard. There's that on guardness. Projecting yourself across the room to see who's there is, I think, studies that show it raises our cortisol levels. It's the privilege of being unmarked in society,
mm-hmm.
that you don't have to think about yourself. You don't have to think every time you step a threshold. You don't have to wonder whether somebody is in a bad mood today. Well, they're just in a bad mood. They have a stomachache. You don't have to think, oh no, they're going to kill me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I think also the impact of a surveillance state that we are now having with algorithms means that a lot more people than simply marked, racially marked
yes.
populations are starting to feel this sense. And that's what I think Nicholas Mirzoff writes about selfie culture, you know,
mm-hmm,
or
mm-hmm.
we all think about selfie cultures. But this sense of we don't see ourselves unless we see ourselves through a camera
yeah.
watching ourselves. And that transformation of not just looking out at the world, but looking even at ourselves through our cell phone cameras is a kind of move towards something like double consciousness. And I don't think it's particularly free of stresses. It's narcissistic. It's got its vanity. But I think that there are other concerns in the sense that this is a monitoring for a certain kind of normativity of status. For it monitors our behavior, it suppresses the quirky, and I think ultimately it's even if we're not worried about being killed because we're being watched, the fact that we're being watched is a way of suppressing a certain kind of mobility that is related to creativity. And I think it's the best part about the American experiment is that people were constantly came to this, to the United States for purposes of reinvention, for redefining themselves. Black people have not always been party to that, but I think that it is the source of a great... You could move someplace and start over, and there was forgiveness in that. Algorithms never forget who you are. You are always defined by your worst moment in life, or the potential of that. And that's a reimposition of a kind of status that's almost futile, and I think that that's... That's a combination that we should think about.
Yes, absolutely. Well, Patricia Williams, your work has been immensely inspiring for so many legal scholars and other researchers and people. So it's been wonderful to speak with you, and you've been incredibly generous with your time.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. This is fun.
I thank you very much.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Countersign. Thank you for joining me. For more information, please visit countersignisapodcast.com.